My special guests today are Professor Ingrid Winship, who is Executive Director of the Office for Research at Melbourne Health, and Professor Melissa Southey, who is from the Department of Pathology at the University of Melbourne. Thank you, ladies, both for your time. You two have co-authored a clinical focus for the MJA on multiple gene panel testing for breast cancer. And I wanted to talk to you a bit about why this is a good idea, as opposed to the single gene testing that's happening now. Can you tell me a little bit about why multiple gene panel testing is better?
Perhaps I can give you a clinical perspective and then Melissa can explain the science that underpins the ability to do this.
Terrific.
So in a clinical sense, we're very keen to understand what the genetic basis of breast cancer, but also lots of other cancers and indeed lots of other diseases that run in families. The advantage of knowing the genetic basis is that you can then use that information about the genotype to predict who's at high risk and to then manage that risk. So the risk exists whether you know it or not, but the ability to manage it is at least guided by the presence of a mutation. So if you have a family where there appears to be a high incidence of breast cancer, finding a mutation in somebody who's got cancer can firstly direct the management of that person, and there are clinical trials of quite specific drugs, and secondly can be used to test other unaffected women across the generation, sometimes the older generation and definitely the offspring, so that their risks can be assessed as accurately as possible and then of course managed. And we have increasing numbers of evidence-based protocols for some genes, not for all, where we're able to manage that risk as effectively as possible.
So we know about BRCA1 and 2, but surely not all breast cancers that are familial predispositions are caused by those two genes.
You're absolutely right. Less than 20% of the people who come to our clinics who have been selected to come to a family cancer clinic because of a predominance of breast cancer or cancer in the family. So they would appear to be the more likely families to have a genetic predisposition. Okay, so less than 20% of families where there is a family history suggestive that there's an inherited predisposition to breast cancer have mutations in the BRCA1 or BRCA2. Which has led scientists like Melissa to look for the so-called missing heritability, that other 80% of explanation. So technology has moved a long way, and perhaps Melissa can explain.
I guess to go back to your question why is panel testing better?
Yeah.
I think there's lots of aspects to that, and some of them we've tried to bring out in the piece. But some of those aspects are actually cause tension and have created this situation where I don't think anyone's suggesting that this is an ideal situation, but this is where we find ourselves. And from a laboratory point of view, one of the reasons for us being in this position today is that the technology is available and it is not terribly difficult to apply in a fairly trained situation, but it's being rapidly translated into diagnostic testing laboratories and the robust parameters around offering genetic testing in a diagnostic service using this technology are being met.
Yeah.
So it's becoming a fairly straightforward technical thing to provide these sorts of services, not just in Australia, but of course around the world. And a lot of this has actually been pushed in the commercial sector, been a very large push from commercial units that provide direct to the public testing on these sorts of platforms. So they're not difficult to set up in that sense anymore. It's fairly straightforward. The technology is quite well understood. And it's fairly cheap to deliver, in a sense. I know there's lots of ways you can measure what's cheap and what's not cheap, but at the bench level, it's fairly cheap to deliver. And the parameters around how many genes we can test with a certain budget has got extraordinarily large. So there really is no restriction anymore, as we had 10 years ago, that every couple of bases that we sequenced in one gene was, you know, a calculable cost. It's no longer like that.
Right.
We can really do a very large amount of genetic testing without a lot of limit around budgets.
So given there's this 80% of misinheritability.
So what's happening?
Multiple tests makes much more sense.
It does, except what are we going to put on these panels? The panels are full of genes that, you know, somebody somewhere has published a bit of data that we probably think that they're connected to breast cancer predisposition in some way, but the evidence around a very large number of genes on these panels is very thin. So we're in, you know, we can put all these genes on a panel, but what we can't do is interpret the data that comes off the panel tests. In the vast majority of genes on these tests, we actually don't know how to interpret the data.
So has the commercial side of this enterprise jumped the gun?
Yes and no. In some ways, doing it this way means that data is being generated to answer the questions that we need answered. And there's an increasing appreciation from some of the large commercial units that are increasingly collaborative, that they understand, and I guess probably because they have this data in their hands and they're finding it very hard to interpret, that collaboration with academic centres and collaboration with research institutions en masse internationally is a productive way of moving this field forward so that we can gather the data that we need to be able to interpret the data in the future. So, there, you know, for me, there's a lot of different aspects to this, but today, this is where we're sitting.
So if I come along with a family history of breast cancer and say to you, let's find out what we can, and we do a multiple gene test panel, presumably I'm going to find out if I have BRCA1 or 2. What else might I find that I may or may not want to find?
That's the issue, is that you can put as many or as few genes on a panel as you wish.
Mm.
So we illustrated the manuscript in the MJA with a case where a mutation in the PALB2 mutation was found, which is on some of the panels, but not all. And that's a gene that there is a fair amount of information on. Melissa and I and others have written papers about the fact that the PALB2 gene is ready for clinical translation. There is enough information now to put this gene onto a panel and use it in clinical practice. But there are many other genes that are less clear. And if I just rewind to your prior question as well, as the person who holds the budget. So genetic testing in Australia is not covered by any private insurance. There is very limited access to Medicare rebate.
Yep.
I think the VHL gene has a Medicare rebate, but certainly none of the breast cancer genes have a Medicare rebate. So we're left with state-funded genetic services, of which there are many across the country, who have a budget that they have to fairly distribute across the population. So in that situation, there's always going to be a set of criteria. We have algorithms that work out the likelihood of finding a mutation, which is pitched very much at BRCA1 and 2. And if you have a 10% likelihood of finding a mutation in a family, and one of the affected members, the most likely person in the family to have a mutation, will be tested. And therein we get the results we have. So at the moment, the panels that are being used are quite small, and for good reason, because we're nervous about putting in too many genes that we can't interpret.
Yes.
And we're nervous about giving people genetic information for which we don't know the clinical utility, which is very different than the interpretation. If Melissa looks at a mutation, she can tell whether it's likely to be causing a problem or not by the way the gene has changed and the way it interacts with the protein that it codes for. But for me as a clinician, what does that mean in terms of what I'm going to do with the patient?
Yeah.
So we know that if you have a BRCA1 gene mutation and you have a bilateral Salpingo oophorectomy, which in normal language is having your ovaries and fallopian tubes removed around the age of 40 or before the natural menopause, the risk of breast cancer is halved, and the risk of ovarian cancer, which is the other high-risk situation, is substantially reduced too. So this is a process which has evidence around it, a protocol that I can confidently advise particularly young women with a BRCA1 mutation who've never had any cancer to go through. But the same doesn't apply to lots of those genes, particularly on some of the commercial international panels.
So there are unintended consequences?
Potentially.
Potentially.
There's a lot of genetic information we just cannot interpret. in a classic sense around BRCA1, we've developed this set of language about pathogenic mutations and unclassified variants and variants of uncertain clinical significance, but they've been very much designed to deal with the BRCA1 and 2 situation. So they've been more difficult to use in a very systematic way for clinical use for other genes where we know the magnitude of risks are probably different. I think we're beginning to understand that we're having to move away from talking about a BRCA1 mutation, for instance, and actually talk about the mutation. Because even in BRCA1, we have examples now where some mutations convey much greater risk than others. So, you know, you could extrapolate and expect that other genes that we know much less about today will also be like that. So it's getting much more difficult to be confident in calls grouping mutations in groups by their nature, given that we have this other evidence in some of them.
Which, again, is no genes. Again, as well, we need these international studies with multiple people collaborating, because to understand the effects, we need large numbers. And we also need longitudinal studies. We need to be able to follow up people to see the natural history of this disease. We've only known about these genes for 20, 25 years. We've known of their existence. Yeah. And we've only used them in clinical practice in, I'd say, the last 20 years, and increasingly over that time. So there's a lot to be learned. It absolutely requires the multidisciplinary approach, where in the olden days, you'd have a practitioner who would make decisions for patients. You can't do that anymore. I mean, the team that we work in has scientists, clinicians, epidemiologists, mathematicians, ethicists, counsellors. The convergence of all these different disciplines is absolutely pivotal to create the understanding.
To getting the right answer.
Yeah.
So ethically, what are we talking about? Mrs. Smith out in the world sees Angelina Jolie getting a double mastectomy and having her ovaries and fallopian tubes removed and goes, I've got this gene. How do we make it simpler for Mrs. Smith and her friends and her family without giving her information that is either going to scare her or be of no use to her whatsoever?
I guess that's what I do every day. Absolutely, Angelina Jolie has been, I think, a good advocate for empowerment of people through knowledge.
Yes.
And I think those are words that she's used herself. The reality is that your Mrs. Smith, if she has a BRCA mutation, has a high risk.
Yeah.
A lot of people say, is it an if or a when I get cancer? And we always remind people that very few genes are 100% going to cause the cancer. There's a concept called penetrance of genes, which is how likely it is that if you have a mutation, a disease-causing change in a gene, how likely it is that that will actually cause the disease. And so these genes are variably penetrant, and very few of the familial cancer genes are anywhere near 100. There are one or two that are very high. The breast cancer genes, none of them are that high. And it's very difficult, again, needs large-scale studies to quantify. And as Melissa said, it's a bit reductionist to say, well, a BRCA1 gene causes this risk, because we know that the way the gene changes might cause a higher or a lower risk. And we're trying to understand that. But what it means is coming into a clinic and exploring what your family history means, maybe having genetic testing, having the counselling and educative approach around that, having the clinical input to assess risk. And it's not only family history. Family history is only one component. So again, the actual tumour, the pathology characteristics, what the pathologist sees down the microscope, will guide us in a direction as well. The hormone receptors will guide us. All sorts of different things guide us in different ways. And the combination of breast and ovarian cancer takes us in one direction as opposed to breast cancer only. So there are lots of things to consider, but this is where we move towards the personalised medicine approach, that your Mrs. Smith comes in and explores her family history. We verify, we find out the pathology, we confirm that what we're dealing with is actually how the family have reported it, and then put that into practice. And then if a mutation is found, then they follow a pathway. Of course, if no mutation is found, which is most people.
Yes.
We still use the information we've got to try and calculate a risk into a high risk or a medium or a population risk,
yeah,
and appropriately screen, which may be MRI, it may be mammography, the intervals may differ, but each family is evaluated on their own situation.
Well, there's a lot of work to be done, but fortunately the technology that I was describing, yeah, of course is going to help us, because we can do genetic research at a rate that we could not do it 5 years ago. So it is now feasible to think about collecting the sorts of information that we have today about BRCA1 mutation carriers, not in the next 20 years, but probably in the next 5 years. We, yeah, actually can do it. And we're very organised internationally now to do this across Europe and across the US, and we actually have things in trans that we really hope will bring the data forward, that we'll be able to make better interpretations of the genetic information really quite rapidly. The more problematic one, I think, is the following of individuals that are found to have what we think are cancer predisposing mutations in this other spectrum of genes.
Yes.
To follow them long enough to know about the disease course in these people is going to be more problematic, but there are of course very well established research resources,
yeah,
that have been following people in a way that's appropriate for these sorts of studies, not knowing their mutation carriers. So we have lots of these resources in Australia, and the US have several cohorts like this where they have been following people through their life, knowing that they're at risk of cancer but not knowing why. So I think even in that context we have real capacity to address some of these things in the next 5 years. But in that period there's going to be a lot of uncertainty for people who undertake these tests and have genetic variants identified that we can't interpret. That large box of uncertain genetic information is going to be quite problematic, and I think it's probably going to be most challenging in the genetic counselling.
Well, absolutely.
Managing people.
In as much as Melissa articulates that it's difficult enough for us to interpret,
yeah,
you can imagine that if it's your own personal data, it becomes even more. It's a tricky one, because even in a clinical setting, if we find that there's a clearly disease-causing gene change, that's quite straightforward.
Yes.
Hard to hear for the patient, but there's a plan. If we find that there are changes in the gene that are just variations on a theme, they're benign changes, that's pretty easy, we discount those. But in the middle, there are these variants of uncertain circumstance, which are very difficult, because it's very difficult to say there's nothing there, but we don't know what they mean. We sometimes lean one way or the other, and sometimes we reclassify them. My practice is to tell people that we found something that we can't interpret, because I think patient autonomy is really important.
Yeah.
People wish to know. I don't think it's my job to sanitize the information. So if there is something that I have difficulty interpreting, which may possibly have significance, I will explain that in an honest way, say there is something in that gene. At the moment, we don't know what it means, and at the moment, it has no clinical utility. The most dangerous situation would be if you had a family full of women with a high risk of breast cancer. You overinterpreted one of these uncertain changes and found somebody free from that change, released them from high-risk screening, didn't follow the evidence program, and they developed cancer.
Yeah.
But conversely, if you overinterpreted and you sent a 37-year-old woman to have her breasts and ovaries and tubes removed and then found that it wasn't a mutation and, in fact, her risk of breast cancer was no greater than her next-door neighbour, you won't have necessarily done her much of a service either.
No.
And heaven forbid, somebody going for surgery for the wrong reason, having a complication of surgery, and remember, every time we intervene in medicine, there's always some small risk.
Yes.
We have to have that concept of equipoise. Do no harm and balance where you're going to, you know, do the most good for people. So we do tend to talk about them, but in a context of non-use. And in our letters to the general practitioners, we make it abundantly clear. The other thing that is a standard of care in genetic practice is we write letters to patients.
Yeah.
Because having a genetic test, having an uninterpretable answer, going home and explaining it to your family, who then explain it to others,
yes,
could turn into
Chinese whispers.
Another set of interpretation, absolutely.
Yeah.
And so we document and in writing what we've discussed so that it makes it easier for people.
So to summarise, multiple gene panel testing is faster, cheaper, and collects data, but comes with some
provisos.
Yeah.
I think one of the other points that I didn't make before is that up until now, we've almost all genetic testing has been what I call iterative testing. So you pick the most likely gene, and if you don't find the answer, then you go to the next most likely gene.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we alluded to in the manuscript was that in our cardiac genetic clinic,
yes,
this is already standard of care. So if you've got a cardiac arrhythmia, and particularly when you have the tragic loss of a young person in sport where there's nothing abnormal to find at post-mortem, looking for an explanation both to explain the loss and to explain what risks might occur across the rest of the family and how one might protect the rest of the family, there are many genes. You can't see anything.
Yeah.
There are many genes that may play a role. Of course, no gene might play a role. So we've developed these panels, and we find that we're answering more questions this way, and we're also, and when I say we, I mean I'm a clinician, we collectively,
yes,
in collaboration with lots of labs, and we use lots of labs in Melbourne, in Australia and around the world, because we sometimes have to look outside our shores to find answers. But the ability to look at all those genes in one go,
mm,
saves a fortune. And so where we may have spent several thousand dollars in trying to answer a clinical question that really needs to be answered for the safety of families,
yeah,
we're now able to do it in one go.
Thank you both for your time.
That's a pleasure.